Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We're joined by former Congressman Dave Jolly, who just confessed to me that he hasn't been on a computer in what? In months?
You don't in do months? Yes. You know, look, when I got to Congress, I pretty much went offline altogether. So if somebody emails me, I always say, you got to text me and tell me you sent me something, because otherwise I'm not going to see it. I'm off email.
Well, I was explaining to you that I was having computer problems. I was literally on my third computer this morning. People, who listen to the podcast, might not realize that we're scattered all over America. You're in Florida. I'm in Wisconsin. We're doing this via Skype. And this has nothing to do with anything, except I had a little small drama that has created massive sort of cascading complications in my life. So I'm sitting,
Charlie, here. as long as Russia's not listening, we're okay.
Oh, Russia's listening. Trust me, they have my number. Someday I'll tell you the story of my phone and Russian. So I'm sitting here in the middle of writing a piece for The Bulwark and for another publication as well, and I hear a scream from the other room, and it's my wife, who found a mouse in the utility room. Okay. Now, that has its own story, because, she basically said, she said to me, what should I do with the mouse? And I said, well, you have two choices. You either, sort of put an end to the mouse, like right away, or you take it upstairs and find a baby bottle and nurse it back to health. And, and I was kind of being sarcastic, which she did. She actually took the bottle. No, it's on her Twitter feed. She spent the whole day. This little mouse who's the luckiest mouse in the world won the mouse lottery, but that's not the story. Okay.
So she's got a good heart. Good heart.
When she screamed, our 130-pound German Shepherd does exactly what you'd expect him to do, right? Which is to run into my study and hide under my desk. Okay. Now, under my desk, there's all of the connections for the computer, all of the cords, all of the plugs, et cetera. And so he's under there, and then he hears another noise and bolts out from under, which has the effect of basically shutting down my entire computer, creating all of these cascading problems. And even this morning, it refuses to reload. It refuses to reload Skype. So I'm telling you this story to explain how a mouse in the utility room leads to a dog under my desk, which leads to God knows what else.
Wait. There's a Dr. Seuss book about this, isn't it? Makes the elephant jump and the earth quakes. We just had our daughter 5 weeks ago. I'll figure out what Dr. Seuss book that is. I'll report back to you.
Well, see, now this is also why I'm bringing this up, because I'm figuring that mouse stories will be relevant to you again. So congratulations being a new dad.
Oh, thank you. It's awesome. She, like every parent would say, she's perfect. She's perfect. We love her.
You're going to be going to soccer games into your 70s, you realize.
Listen, I'm having kids late in life. Trust me, I've looked at that actuarial table. It's very intimidating.
All right. Well, let's dive into the news of the day. And we'll start off by talking about Bill Barr and the fact that, first of all, what we've learned about what an unreliable narrator he was, his bizarre performance, embarrassing performance, I think, in front of the Senate, his refusal to go and testify in front of the House, and the way this is all spinning out. It's interesting. I'm reading a piece from the Daily Beast. The Trump White House is loving itself some Bill Barr. He dismembered the Democrats. And here's this line that jumped out at me. White House officials maintained the decision to ghost on the House Judiciary Committee was Barr's alone, but among allies of the president, it was a glorious little F.U. to the nattering critics in Congress. So Bill Barr is doing his job by flipping off a co-equal branch of government.
He is. And, look, I've worked with Capitol Hill for 20 plus years in every role from intern to member. I'm a practicing attorney. So there are a couple themes that Barr speaks to that on paper, I would say, yes, he's technically right. But then there's a reality. The two areas where I think he does have an argument is, I believe, very rare, if not unprecedented, for a cabinet secretary, and that's very important, for a cabinet secretary to be cross-examined by staff counsel. Of course, we saw it with Blasey Ford, a woman of remarkable courage, and despite everything she brought to the hearing, she simply is not a sitting cabinet secretary, so I don't think that's a parallel. If you go back to Watergate, the reality is there were open impeachment inquiries, and so it was appropriate. And if we're going to use that as a precedent, then we should be talking about impeachment, which is what I'll get to. But the other point, and you know, when he said this was my baby when Mueller handed it to me, he's right. This was a special counsel of the Department of Justice. This was not an independent counsel appointed by the Congress. And so legally, he's right. He didn't have to share this information with the Congress. Now, the question is, should he be behaving this way? And I think the answer is clearly no. I think, Charlie, he lied under oath yesterday. I think Kamala Harris got him. I think Donald Trump and Bill Barr have had conversations about whether or not to investigate political opponents. And I think Bill Barr is not only acting, you know, at the direction and in the interest of the president, but I think he's intentionally obfuscating and obstructing because he feels like he can get away with it. I think the answer for Democrats is to move with more urgency. This whole chapter will only be defined now by how the Democrats handle it. I think they've mishandled it since the day the Mueller report came out. And if they do not move swiftly with urgency, with a gravity that puts impeachment on the table, and we hear that word from Nancy Pelosi every day, then Barr and Trump will continue to get away with this. It's okay, in the Democrats' court, and I think they're fumbling it right now.
Well, let's go back to that. First of all, you said he lied under oath yesterday that Kamala Harris got him. What did he lie about?
So when Kamala Harris said, "Have you had discussions with the president about specific cases to prosecute?" And he said, "I don't know your term." She said, "Did the White House ever suggest that you pursue certain cases?" He said, "I don't know what the word suggest means." And at another point in real time, he said, "Well, I don't know what you mean by others." You know, when she said president or others, he fumbled. And he also struggled in a similar conversation by an earlier questioner. I do believe what it revealed is this White House is looking at who they can investigate. And it may be, as we saw from, I believe, Peter Baker in the New York Times, it may be the Joe Biden matter. It may not be, or Joe Biden's son, it may not be Hillary Clinton. But I think it says that Bill Barr is fully operating in Trump world. And we can't overlook the fact how he arrived at the position by writing the unsolicited memo saying that the special counsel really didn't have the authority to do what he was doing. Trump knows that, and I think Bill Barr is acting behind the scenes in a very sophisticated way to protect the president and, frankly, to further the president's candidacy for re-election in 2020.
Yeah, no, I need a caveat here because I really was an admirer of George H.W. Bush and, you know, think some of the investigations were highly overblown. But yesterday I wrote a piece about the William Safire had written 27 years ago about Bill Barr, called him the cover up general, and involving something called Iraqgate, which turned out not to be that big a deal. But what is interesting is realizing that Bill Barr has been doing this sort of thing for quite a long time, that he's kind of the go-to guy. If you want somebody who's going to shut down an investigation, here's a guy who is able to land the plane. And you do wonder whether or not that was a factor in Donald Trump's selection. Basically say, look, here's a guy who, you know, in the midst of a big investigation, managed to use pardons, used, you know, stalling tactics, did a variety of things to make the problem go away. Now, I think the problem right now for Donald Trump is much more serious than it was back in the early 1990s, but he's been doing this for a long time. Now, David, you also said that you think that the Democrats have been fumbling this since the Mueller report was rolled out. In what way have they been fumbling this? What advice are you offering them that they're ignoring?
Part of me would make the case that this chapter's already over. The Democrats have already blown it. And I'll paint a picture for you, two scenarios. One is what we saw happen, which is the Barr memo sits out there for 4 weeks. Democrats couldn't control that. But then on a Thursday, Barr has his press conference at 9:30, releases the redacted Mueller report at 11. And we heard nothing from Democrats They were on vacation. Congress was on vacation for 2 weeks. Nancy Pelosi was overseas. We never saw proof of life of Chuck Schumer. Steny Hoyer, the number two Democrat, said, well, we'll have an election in 18 months. The committee chairs who did speak to it were not coordinated whatsoever. It was sporadic when we heard from them. The Trump world and Republicans ran with the no collusion, no obstruction message for the next 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
We've yet to hear clarity from Nancy Pelosi. Even her tweet yesterday that history will remember Barr, in dark terms, means nothing if you're not going to actually put some sort of teeth of accountability. So that's one scenario. Imagine another scenario where that Thursday Barr had his press conference, released the report. Nancy Pelosi had flown home. Chuck Schumer had flown home. They met at the Capitol. They had a press conference saying, we consider these matters to be grave in constitutional terms. We are calling the Congress back into session. We are going to open an inquiry as to whether or not these 10 counts of obstruction rise to the level of impeachment. We're not prepared to say today it does, but we believe it might. And so we are moving with urgency. That does a couple of things. It frames for the American people that we truly are facing a president who has violated the Constitution and violated his oath of office. It puts the Democrats on offense. But Charlie, it also does something that Democrats writ large, whether they're for impeachment or not, seem to be begging to do, which is they want to talk about policy. They want to talk about taxes and immigration and health care. The way to do that is not, as they often say, walk and chew gum for the next 12 months talking about investigations and those issues. The way to do that is to settle this matter in the next 90 days, clear the deck by Labor Day, impeach the president or not, and then allow your presidential candidates 12 months to run on policy. We're not seeing that. And one other piece they might consider, which would get you pretty close to that, consider an impeachment inquiry today on Attorney General Bill Barr and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin for obstructing justice when it comes to congressional investigations. Bring them up on impeachment now and force the president to defend his cabinet secretaries and see if the Congress has the will to impeach two cabinet secretaries over this matter. That may be another way to do it. But Charlie, we are not hearing that urgency nor that framing in a coordinated fashion from Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill. And though I have great respect for Nancy Pelosi's legislative prowess, I think she's completely fumbled this. And I think in many ways, this chapter may already be over. Trump won the narrative, and good luck to Democrats going into 2020 on this.
Okay, well how do you answer the argument that, though, that moving ahead on impeachment, you know, pulling out that particular knife, plays into Donald Trump's hands because nothing will rally the base more aggressively to Donald Trump, unite Republicans more than the appearance that the Democrats are overplaying their hands. And so, in particular, you know, after and you, of course, you're right in the framing of the initial narrative: no collusion, no obstruction. He's completely exonerated. And if Democrats had, in fact, moved ahead with impeachment, wouldn't that have fed into the Trumpian narrative? See, they didn't care about the investigation. They just want to get your guy. They want to have this silent coup, and they're coming for our president. We need to circle the wagons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So I'd make a couple points. First, I don't have a lot of patience for people who make a political calculus around this and what it means for 2020, because I think the oath to the Constitution is greater than the oath to the political consequences to your party. But secondly, I would say if you look at history, going into the impeachment in December of 98, in November, the American people, by a majority vote, voted for a Republican Congress. The House only lost five Republican seats. They won again in 2020, a majority vote for the Congress. So you could also make the case that there's not the political consequence that Pelosi is fearful of. But third, the third point is this, and it goes back to what I said earlier. You can take that debate, that argument off the table if you move now. Imagine clearing this issue in the summer of 2019, and then Democrats spend from November of 2019 to November of 2020 talking about policy, saying, yes, we had the impeachment matter. We did what we thought the Constitution required. We're now talking about policy. And if Donald Trump wants to relitigate impeachment, so be it. Let him. But you know as well as I do, particularly for your medium and low intensity voters, the memory is short. And if we cleared the deck this summer of this national conversation, we wouldn't be talking about it going into November of 2020 in the way that Donald Trump hopes we would be.
Yeah, no, see, I've really been torn on this, and you and I have talked about this, I think, on cable television. And, you know, my thought was that the Democrats could somehow, you know, steer between the two, you know, between impeachment and nothing by doing aggressive oversight and hearings. And I do get the sense that this is not happening, that the time is slipping by. And as a result, that will sort of solidify that impression that, okay, there was nothing much there, that the Mueller report was really a damn squib, and that the Donald Trump, you know, may have done some things, but let's move on and talk about something else. Because there is right. a huge, I mean, look, these hearings do move public opinion. They do move the needle, and nothing moves the needle as dramatically right. as these televised hearings. Even folks who watch Fox News would not be able to escape those. Now, of course, we are going to be hearing from Bob Mueller, and that's going to be a hell of a hearing.
It certainly will be. I don't think Democrats are going to get everything they want out of it, which is also why you have to act with commitment, not with political concerns, if you will. Even Don McGahn, I think, needs to testify, but he'll be an imperfect witness as well. To your point, though, Charlie, about kind of the drip, drip, drip and the continued oversight, I would agree to that if it seemed to me that Democrats were really leaning in with a clear move to do that. And what I mean by that, and I don't mean to fault Congress for taking vacations, I'm not trying to take a cheap shot, but are we going to see them open up the calendar for the next 8 weeks, Monday through Friday, to command the airwaves and let the American people watch a coordinated effort of oversight over the president and all of the cabinet officials? Are we going to see the routine Tuesday to Thursday congressional sessions with maybe a hearing or two a week, and then they leave for 5 weeks in August, and then we see them after Labor Day for a couple weeks? Because at that point, you can't control the narrative for the American view. The power, the image that you speak to is right, but only if you deliver it on a daily basis so that the American people truly understand the gravity of it. I don't think, for instance, there's coordination between Nadler and Elijah Cummings about their two committees. And I don't think there's any narrative being laid out by the Speaker, and I would also say Majority Leader Schumer, though he does not control the Senate. He could be making moves right now to grind the Senate to a halt and to speak to what some Democrats and a lot of Americans, regardless of party, would consider a constitutional crisis that may be imminent.
You know, it is interesting. I was just sort of, maybe this will sound nerdy. Well, not to our listeners, but I got my copy of the Mueller report, bound copy, in the mail yesterday. So I started reading it last night. Was reading it this morning, and which reinforced the opinion that I had when I had read the excerpts online before, which is there is just so much that is deeply disturbing and that is troubling about the president's behavior. And you know, reading over the voluminous evidence of the president's obstruction of justice and the reality of the Russian attack. And it hit me again that what you read in this report is so different from the narrative that you hear on talk radio, that you see on Fox News, that you get even from some of the more quote-unquote respectable conservative publications. And yet you do have that frustrating sense that, you know what, you know, 0.005% of the public is sitting and reading this report as opposed to hearing this kind of a narrative. The only way to change that dynamic is what you are suggesting doing, which is the aggressive oversight, the dramatic hearings, because otherwise, I feel like H.L. Mencken here, but you know, if you expect the American public to sit down and actually read this and think about it and absorb it on their own, it's a sucker's bet.
The clearest example of how politicians and people in politics frame an issue is the issue around life and abortion, right? One side argues pro-life, one side argues pro-choice, because the notion of life is something everybody understands. The notion of choice is something everybody understands. At this point, though it's an imperfect analogy, all we hear right now is that the president's a victim, at least what we hear in the most coordinated fashion. We hear no obstruction, no collusion, and the president's a victim, and Democrats are unnecessarily chasing this. Democrats have an opportunity to completely reset that narrative. Say to the American people, the president tried to fire the people investigating him and ordered the White House counsel to memorialize in a memo that he never did that. He tried to cover it up. cover-up. People understand cover-ups. People understand corruption. To your point, what is in the report, where Donald Trump and the Fox News constituency continues to paint him as a victim, the Mueller report paints the president as somebody who tries to advance corruption at every stage mm-hmm. of the investigation. It is corruption, and it is obstruction. Frankly, the first hearing they should have had days after the Mueller report came out is McGahn, McFarlane, Lewandowski, and Mueller, and ask all of them, is what's contained in this report a true and accurate reflection of the facts? And if they say yes, open the impeachment inquiry, because there's mm-hmm. enough there to do it. Charlie, I watched the president's interview with Hannity last week. What caught me by surprise was how much Hannity was leading the president into new conspiracies. And the president didn't even fully understand them. But Hannity spent the first 5 or 10 minutes leading the president towards new conspiracies, both of spying in this investigation, but he was also trying to launch the investigation into Joe Biden's son. Trump didn't even know what he was talking about, but he immediately went to the superlatives. Yes, this is one of the worst acts in political history. The consequences for everybody. He knew what to say, but he had no idea what he was talking about.
You know, this also raises the point that why Democrats need to move more aggressively on all of this, that, if they don't, the president and the Trumpists will, in fact, go on the offensive. And they will, and they've shown the ability to throw out these kinds of conspiracy theories and go on the offensive. Okay, one final word on Bill Barr, because I'm looking at our mutual friend Ben Wittes, who has a piece up in The Atlantic, and he got a lot of flack because he was willing to give Bill Barr the benefit of the doubt, and he's got a piece today saying, hey, sorry about that. Talking about his appearance in front of the Senate, he said, it has been catastrophic. Not in my memory has a sitting attorney general more diminished the credibility of his department on any subject. It is a kind of trope of political opposition in every administration that the attorney general, whoever he or she is politicizing the Justice Department and acting as a defense lawyer for the president. In this case, it is true. And it is skating. Okay, well, let me go to your other point, that if in fact the Democrats had moved aggressively on impeachment, they would clear the decks and they could shift to issues. And let's talk about the issues. You have left the Republican Party. You don't consider yourself a Democrat, correct?
No, I say no. I'm not leaving one bad relationship for another.
Well, because right now the Democrats are really in this sort of fever of free stuff, aren't they? There's this sort of dramatic wish casting that we're going to throw out, free universal health care, free universal daycare, a free universal college, and somehow we'll pay for this by, I don't know, we're going to pay for this somehow. They've convinced themselves that these things are winners. Despite the cost, all the questions, the unintended consequences, we have this new CBO report out basically saying, hey, the transition to a single payer would be really, really messy. You know how these issues actually play out in a campaign. So where are the Democrats right now? I know that there are grown-ups in the Democratic Party that are warning them that, these things are not slam dunks, and I think that if 2020 is a referendum on universal health care, I think Democrats have a real problem.
Yeah, you're right. What I would say, from an economic theory, nothing is free, right? And I think what drives me crazy more than anything is when we talk about free college, free health care. It's not. Even if it's subsidized, even if it's through a program where Americans contribute to and get it back, there is nothing free. We know that as the law of economics. But I think why it's resonating on one side is they are at least speaking in some plain terms to what are the biggest priorities and fears of the American people. What happens if I lose my health care? Mm-hmm. How do I pay for college? What do I do about student debt? And where Republicans, I think, have struggled, and we see it cycle, right? We certainly see the pendulum swing. But I think where Republicans struggle is, how can you tell me that through less government, you're actually going to address those same needs? I mean, in many ways, Democrats are saying, look, we are for helping you. And Republicans are saying, we're against using the tools we have of government to help you. What we're trying to do is dismantle the government in a way that allows you to help yourself. That's a harder sell right now, which is why you're seeing some of the appeal. Now, to your point, And I was amazed. I had a friend who was running a Republican congressional reelect last November, and they were tagging their Democratic opponent with the socialism tag. And I said, does that really work? I mean, it seemed to me a bit aggressive to tag people as socialists. He said that it polls with Republican-leaning voters, whether they're registered Republican or independents, as a bigger hit than tagging them with an association, say, with Nancy Pelosi.
Really?
Which for many cycles has been the biggest hit, which is why you hear it's a poll-tested hit that Republicans are nailing Democrats on, saying socialist. I'm sure Donald Trump will be calling Joe Biden socialist at some point, even though Joe Biden is probably the one in the Democratic Party saying, let's pump the brakes a little bit on some of this. But it also says that in today's age, and social media has a large hand in this, a single Democrat can nationalize a constituency. And so you look in an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's nationalized a constituency around a version of politics that really only work in her district successfully. They don't translate to where you're sitting in Wisconsin or to my in-laws in central Pennsylvania. It doesn't work there.
Well, you know, whether the word or not works, and you know, I take that, you know, at face value that it works. I just think the whole prospect of having a debate where people realize, so I will lose all of my private health insurance. You know, we're going through this something completely unknown. And my concern is that voters are going to go to the polls and they will have, you know, completely taken on board all of Donald Trump's deficiencies, but there is a certain level of known awfulness there, where the Democrats, by coming up with these sweeping, you know, free programs, become the unknown awful out there,
right.
In terms of taxes. But also, I think there is kind of just an unseriousness about some of these proposals. The cost, we haven't really wrestled with the cost inequities, and I don't know whether I've told this story on this podcast or not, but I really remember back in 2016, a Republican congressman from Wisconsin coming back from a meeting of farmers, agricultural interests. And he said, and this was when everybody assumed that Hillary was going to win, he said, you know, I think the Democrats are going to lose this election, because he'd heard a Democrat talking to this group about, you know, her idea of free college education for everyone. And he says, all these farmers are sitting there going, what the hell? You know, you want me to pay to send somebody else's kid to, you know, get a degree and French flower arranging? And you could just see that whole idea of free stuff was just backfiring. And I'm just not sure that the Democrats understand how that plays. And also they're in this increasing bubble of wokeness where they're talking to one another about issues that you know, quite frankly, just are distinguished by the irrelevance to voters in rural Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Minnesota, and Iowa. And and what I'm noticing,
and look, you
probably have noticed how they're not really open to a lot of advice from guys like us.
No, you're right. And I understand that. You know, for me, I'm not a member of the Democratic Party. But take the free tuition issue. I mean, isn't that really a state issue? If a state wants to do it and state taxpayers determine how to do it, we've seen creative ways to make college more affordable. If they want to make it free, well, then treat it like a public high school system and let state voters decide if that's the case. To your point, and again, I understand the hesitancy, but you know, when Mayor Pete came out, he made a comment about he disagrees with Chick-fil-A's policies on LGBT and some of the family issues, but he loves their chicken. And I complimented him as I said, you know, that's a Democrat who is trying to take hard conversations of identity politics and intersectionality to communities that haven't had those conversations. And the moment I said that, the advocates who want to talk about identity politics and intersectionality on the left really hit me for saying, how dare you suggest that you're somebody that could broach this topic? And I got it. Message received, right? I'm not welcome to that conversation.
You're not supposed to even talk about it.
Right. And I understand in one lane, I do. But also to your point, and some of this is the fact, I think there was a study, you know, the politics of Twitter don't translate to Main Street. And that's a reality as well. But Democrats, and this is where they've got a race with 21 candidates now. I do think they're going to figure this out. I've actually, if I were to look at the bright side, I think Democrats have realized this is an issue among competing ideologies within their tent that they need to get right. And I actually think they're going to get it right going into 2020.
Well, it is interesting. And by the way, here's a puzzle. Maybe you have some insight into this. Okay, so Michael Bennett, with one T, senator from Colorado, has just jumped in the race, which makes him, what, the 84th candidate? No, actually, just 21st, okay? So he's getting into a race in which there is, you know, every lane is clogged right now. What is the calculation for all of these guys getting into the race? I mean, what am I missing here? Is this the only way you get on cable television is to be a candidate for president now?
That's part of it, actually. Yes, that's one of the reasons. So some are running for a cabinet position, and I know that firsthand, that some know they likely won't even make it out of Iowa and New Hampshire, but if they can run the right way, you know, it elevates their profile. Maybe they end up in a cabinet position. Some are doing it simply for the ability to raise money in a different account. It is nothing more than just a reflection of today's campaign finance laws, that it gives them a constituency to go out and raise money from. But that, look, if you're one of the 21, the odds are against every single one of them. I mean, Joe, the odds are against Joe Biden actually coming out of this on top, right? Because you've got 21 of them. For some, it's certainly a vanity project. Others are taking a flyer. Some are taking a long-term view. How does this set me up for either a place in the next administration or perhaps the opportunity to run again in 4 or 8 years? Take Mayor Pete. I've said a lot of great things about him. I think he is an important candidate for the national conversation in 2020. I don't think he's prepared to be president, and I know he brings remarkable qualifications. We all get to make our own judgment. Some people think Joe Biden's too old. I think Mayor Pete's too young. I think I'm too young to be president, and I got 10 years on Mayor Pete.
Interestingly enough, a little fun fact about Michael Bennett, and this will be the last time we'll ever talk about him, I'm sure. He was born in New Delhi, India. So we're going to have all the New Delhi truthers there at some point. I had no idea. You know, no. Okay, so the last time you appeared on the Bulwark podcast, you surprised me a little bit because you were, and this was a long time ago now, but you surprised, a long time ago, we started in January, so that's I'm old enough to remember. No, that you were somewhat enthusiastic or certainly open to the idea of the Howard Schultz independent candidacy. You know, since then, I don't think he's gotten a lot of traction. I don't think he's caught fire, even though with the rise of Bernie on the Democratic side and the what appears to be the increasingly likely renomination of Donald Trump on the Republican side, his independent candidacy, the rationale has become that much stronger, but it's not happening for him. Am I missing something?
No, I think you're right. He hasn't caught fire. And if anything, it's been a very tough few months for him. I'll surprise you again, though, and say I still think we shouldn't overlook his candidacy. And what I mean by that is he does not have to peak until next September or October. Frankly, he doesn't even have to emerge again on the national scene until the Democratic and Republican conventions of next August. And what I mean by that is his voters. And this is a bit of a gamble on his part, right? But it's clear to me that the voters that would consider his candidacy are going to be the medium to low intensity voters who are distrustful of the two major parties and won't start paying attention to the presidential campaign until, honestly, Labor Day of next year, when they now know, okay, the Democratic nominee is this person. Donald Trump has been renominated as a Republican. And look, there's this Howard Schultz character who's on TV every single moment I turn on my cable box. Does that mean he has a chance? He's viable? I would still say the odds are not great, given what we've seen in the past few months. But if he decides to pull the trigger, I still think he's going to be underestimated because there is a very feasible way to lay out a strategy for next fall where Howard Schultz could outperform where a lot of people think he's going to end up in this race should he run.
No, I actually don't disagree with that at all. In fact, you know, at a time when there was a brief window when really I'd convinced myself that Bernie Sanders was going to be the nominee, I'm not quite so concerned about that now. I mean, he certainly could be the nominee, and I'm thinking where are guys like us going to go? I mean, what are we going to do?
True.
If it is, you know, nationalism versus socialism. I mean, you know, I think we've gotten used to being orphans out here on an, you know, on an ice floe. But the ice floe would be melting. And I don't know. I've mixed too many
That's
metaphors
right.
here. I don't know how I'm going to get from the ice floe to Howard Schultz, but you know where I'm going.
And no, I do. And where I, you know, I've totally ripped the Band-Aid off and registered as an independent, so it's easy for me to say this, but I bristle when people suggest that I need to abide by the convention of supporting one of the two major party candidates. I do understand the argument that you don't want to strengthen Donald Trump's hand in a reelection if you're truly concerned about his presidency, and so that is part of my calculus for who I would pull the lever for. But to suggest that because I don't want Donald Trump elected, I necessarily have to choose the nominee of the opposing major party.
Right.
I don't buy that, frankly. And my inspiration for saying I don't buy that goes back to George Washington. That this simply is a creation of the last 240 years. And I'm willing to say there was a purer time when we didn't have to abide by those conventions.
Yeah, I think that any time you get pushed into this argument that it's a binary choice, you basically have said you're going to have to put your, you know, at least half of your brain in cold storage for the next elective cycle.
Right.
And I think we've seen how that works out. We've seen what happens when, you know, if you basically sign up with a tribe, then you're in, and then you find yourself rationalizing what's going on. You make excuses for it, and before you know it, you're out there, you know, with a red hat waving, you know, going, you know, this is the best president ever, or yes, I do want a national. The means of production. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. We're not going to do that. So,
no, but that said, I do think the likelihood that Democrats nominate somebody that has cross-party appeal is still pretty high. I mean, I think there is real strength in Joe Biden's numbers. And I think even if you took a Kamala Harris, who would technically be more progressive than Joe Biden where she stands today, it'd be interesting what she looks like as a general election candidate, you know, what platform she articulates. So I'm excited as an independent to wait all the way until November to decide how I'm going to end up voting.
So how do we get a copy of this podcast into Nancy Pelosi's office? I think she's got to hear what you had to say there.
You know, Charlie, the irony, and I endorsed the blue wave and said Democrats need to take over. And it's interesting because I feel like I'm fighting harder than most Democrats today for Nancy Pelosi to move aggressively on this president. But I know there are others out there, and I am curious whether or not Nancy Pelosi is missing the pulse of, if you will, the resistance or the blue wave, much like Republicans overlooked the pulse of the Tea Party early on. A lot of people voted for Democrats last November for exactly this moment because they thought House Democrats would move aggressively. And I think a lot of those people are disappointed in what they've seen the last 2 weeks.
I wonder how much of that is because it turned out to be so difficult. She was so challenged early on by, you know, the trio of really controversial young freshmen who seemed to be sucking all the oxygen out of the Democrats' room. And she was having really hard time basically saying, you know, they don't necessarily, AOC is not the face of the future of the Democratic Party. That maybe that made her, I'm just spitballing here, made her excessively cautious. Because I did find myself, and I will admit, I did find myself, you know, early on thinking, you know, saying things that I never thought I would say, which is that that Nancy Pelosi is the voice of reason, that she was the prudent person. But even prudence in excess is excessive. You can be too prudent.
Right. And I think you're exactly right. And her strength is the prudence. Right. That's, right. And her strength is in her prudence. People respect that. But I think in this environment, if it truly is a significant matter in the Mueller report, then she has to act with decisiveness and urgency. If it's not a grave matter in the Mueller report, well, then she's handling it exactly how she should handle it. But if that's the case, then we should just move on.
No, and I think you made a point earlier that I should have underlined, which is that, you know, we do get focused in on the political ramifications, and it is very difficult to disentangle the politics from all of this. But also, this is a constitutional moment, and this is a historically an historic institutional challenge. If Congress does not take this seriously, then it will once again have taken a rather dramatic step toward the degradation of its constitutional responsibilities. You know, and the this notion that the President of the United States is literally above the law ought to be very disturbing across the board, and it will have long-term consequences. If the President is committing felonies and Congress says, yeah, we would do something about it, except we're worried about the poll numbers right now, that's not going to be looked on kindly by history.
Now, this entire chapter will be defined with the seriousness with which Democrats define it as. If they do not suggest that it's a grave matter that requires an urgent response from the Congress, then history will forever record that there was an investigation into the president that left Congress agreeing with Bill Barr's interpretation, that in fact there was no matter that required Congress to hold the president fully accountable for his actions. That's how it will be recorded. That Congress ultimately sided on the side of Bill Barr's discretion not to charge. If Congress, however, decides to open an impeachment inquiry, it will be remembered as a grave matter and recorded as such. This is in the Democrats' hand to define whether this is a serious constitutional matter or just a blip on the historic radar.
David Jolly, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast and talking with us. I appreciate it very much.
Hey, great to be with you, Charlie. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.